You and the World with Dwight Cook. The past year has brought a good many impressive and encouraging developments in science. This week, Mr. Cook and his guests will be discussing some of those which affect you most directly. And for the first of these informal conversations, his guest is Mr. Donald G. Cooley, managing editor of three magazines, Your Health, Your Life, and Woman's Life, author of The New Way to Eat and Get Slim, and widely known science writer. Now, here is Dwight Cook.
Well, Mr. Cooley, you have indeed a thankless job today. With all the science discoveries of the last year in all the different fields, you have the exceedingly simple assignment of, in some 13 minutes, bringing me up to date on anything that's important that I ought to know about. I hope your white hair is going to get whiter before you get through here.
Especially the ones I don't have up there.
In preparing for this, I understand, made a kind of an informal poll of some of your fellow experts.
Yes, we did, Mr. Cook.
I don't want to start out by making it more difficult for you, but weren't you associated with a very famous magazine that had something to do with polls?
Oh, I think you mean the old Literary Digest.
Could I thought be? I'd let you say the title yourself.
Yes, indeed. I was associated with the old Digest as the science and medicine editor when Mr. Landon was competing with Mr. Roosevelt in 1936.
Known as the good old days.
Good old days, yes. And I think everyone knows what happened to our poll then, but of course, since 1948, we've been joined by the great majority and have lost our eminence.
I think that leaves the score 40-love, Mr. Cooley. Indeed, you have. Anyone who was right in 48 is so rare as to be practically wrong in saying so. But coming down to the serious things now, is there any most important discovery of the last year? Is there anything that you think is preeminent?
Well, it seems to me that you have to mention the H-bomb first as a preeminent story of 1950, because 100,000 years from now, looking back, if we are left to look back, people will recognize that as an important development of 1950.
This beginning of exploration of the Hell bomb probably being the most significant thing which is happening.
In its implications and its potential significance, certainly. Some of the other things we are going to discuss tonight, as one looks back in years to come, will probably seem important, too. The difficulty with assessing the most outstanding science stories of any year is that you may not realize that's what they are until some time has gone past. It's like the base of a pyramid.
Still, it is very satisfying to be able to take that H-bomb and everything about it and just push it away and let people worry about it at some later time. I think that's the most optimistic thing I can say about the Hell-bomb right now. So give me something really optimistic to counter the horrors of what we've read about that and its possibilities.
Well, to counter the horrors of that, certainly one of the significant stories of science development in 1950 is the advance in antibiotics. It's 10 years since we first used penicillin therapeutically.
Only 10 years since?
Only yesterday. And now, of course, we have a whole armamentarium of antibiotic drugs. Terramycin is the antibiotic that Dr. Perrin Long of Johns Hopkins called the outstanding development in its field for 1950.
Kind of a grandchild of penicillin.
It belongs to the same family, but tackles a different variety of infectious organisms. Penicillin, of course, is remarkably effective against many bacteria.
But terramycin becomes another lifesaver. And incidentally, my guest, Dr. Kane, tomorrow is going to be talking about that. So I think we might as well leave that to him and leave you for more important things.
He will speak much more authoritatively on it.
Well, he will at least have a whole broadcast for just one thing instead of hop, skipping, and jumping. Take another hop, Mr. Cooley. Take another hop.
Well, this is a short hop, since it also relates to antibiotics, and that is their use in animal feed supplements. In the manufacture of terramycin and antibiotic drugs in general, it's a fermentation process, and always at the bottom of the tank, there's a kind of a mash left over for which there's no particular use in the past. And it has been discovered, much to the surprise of those concerned originally, that when minute amounts of this leftover waste mash are added to animal feeds, the animals thrive enormously. They attain their ideal growth much faster and more economically than on what ordinarily would be considered very good diets. There's some factor there.
You've hit on something else we'll be discussing later this week when Dr. McGinnis is talking about that, and I'm certainly going to be trying to find out from him what connotations that has, for instance, on feeding to babies or expectant mothers. I hope that's going to be a very optimistic future, because it was certainly an unexpected thing, as you said a minute ago.
It was unexpected. Of course, if you apply it to human infants, I've observed that their growth is as rapid as is consistent with parental control anyhow.
Sometimes, from the non-parent's point of view, the growth is even more rapid. How about something which is not concerned in the field of medicine as such, a discovery of the last year?
Well, not in the field of medicine, but very personal to all of us, something we can't get away with, or from, rather, is rain, the weather in general.
My, if you live in the New York area as we do, it certainly has been difficult to get away from it the last year.
I suppose you probably would be inclined to blame Dr. Wallace Howell for that. He, of course, is the famous rainmaker hired by New York City to fill its reservoirs, and with rather startling success, although Dr. Howell's himself has been very modest about making claims as to his success in this field. The inhabitants of the Catskill areas upstate are very well convinced that that he spoiled their apple crops by washing off their sprays as soon as they got them on the trees.
More than that, he's about the only alibi the Weather Bureau here in New York has for the last few months, because they have been conspicuous by some of the most spectacular wrong guesses about the next 12 hours as of the last summer, as conspicuous as anybody else. And unless they can blame it on Dr. Howell's dropping of, what is it, silver iodide?
Silver iodide smoke is one technique, but also dry ice crystals dropped through the clouds. They're experimenting with different methods.
Well, I like to think for the Weather Bureau's accuracy that it was Dr. Howell who kept crossing them up by urging the clouds to precipitate rain after they predicted less unpleasant seaside weather. But at least you feel it in this a great discovery in man controlling his environment to grow crops or a more comfortable life?
This, I think you could look upon as a start in a direction that may indeed be very vital to all of our human surroundings. Not only crop control, but you get into other difficulties. Who owns the rain? There are legal problems involved there. And we're going to see quite a development in those fields, I'm sure, within a short time.
All right, give me still another now. You certainly took a big jump from feeding antibiotic waste products to chickens over to rain clouds.
Well, let us go into the social sciences, which a good many skeptics have sometimes charged aren't too scientific. The publication of Dr. William H. Sheldon's book, Varieties of Delinquent Youth, in 1950, I think is a landmark in a new technique brought to the social sciences, which really makes them, gives them more of a scientific nature.
What do you mean by more of a scientific nature here? What did he do?
Well, you know, of course, that a great many sociological studies are based on statistics and analyses and conclusions drawn from statistical bases. For instance, you presumably are delinquent because you are born in the slums or have fears, frustrations, don't like your parents, ran away from home, and that sort of thing. Well, Dr. Sheldon has emphasized the correlation of behavior with structure. Structure being your constitution.
Well, then, over-popularizing it, you mean that I can take a look at 100 boys lined up and say, because his structure, Jimmy's structure, is different from Bill's structure, it's more likely that Jimmy is going to be a delinquent, no matter whether he lives in the poorest 5% in the city or not?
Well, unfortunately, you can't do that by looking at them, because the characteristics that make a delinquent happen to be the same ones that are characteristic of some of our most outstanding and successful men. That is, I suppose you are familiar with the basic body types that Dr. Sheldon has...
As long as I don't have to give you their names except to say the thin and spindly, or the tough and athletic, or the fat and slightly weak. Would that do? He had a different set of words, but...
Of course, he has a different set of words, but you've described them essentially very well.
Well, now, which is most likely to be a juvenile delinquent?
The muscle-driven type, whom Dr. Sheldon would call a mesomorph, who also has a touch of... endomorphy, which is the visceral-driven type. The combination of endomorphy with mesomorphy here makes for great vitality and freedom from inhibition, and you can see how that would drive you on to success, whereas someone not so well endowed as you might be using that same energy for purposes of delinquency.
But here Dr. Sheldon takes the type of people and the way the body is put together and the type of bones they have and is able, on the basis of that, to begin predicting certain kinds of social behavior. That must strike pretty hard at the hearts of certain of the psychiatrists.
Well, it does indeed. Dr. Sheldon, of course, doesn't claim to have made more than a beginning in this field, but... I talked to him this afternoon before coming down, and I think I can quote him as saying that he thinks that when psychiatrists speak of the mind, they really mean the body, but would be horrified to know that's what they meant. So you can see that that is rather throwing down the gauge to some of our conventional ideas in the social sciences.
Tis indeed, Mr. Cooley. Later on this week, another thing which I know you would like to mention, if you have the time, some of the new discoveries in heart disease, which is the greatest killer of all. Later on this week, I'm going to have an expert discussing that with me, on Wednesday to be exact. How about things like courtesan? Anything new in that area? Chemical things?
There has been a very recent development in December which highlights the whole magnificent cortisone story, and that was the synthesis of compound F.
A new chemical approach at some of these old ills that we have.
Everyone is familiar now with the uses of cortisone and the marvels it does in arthritis, rheumatism, and
burns. And this compound helps it along.
This compound is somewhat similar. We don't know, the experts don't know what it will do yet. They have synthesized it, and we have a new weapon added to the whole hormone medicine cabinet.
It's very interesting, because as you've gone through these with me, Mr. Cooley, you've covered an immense amount of ground here, everything from the physical sciences to chemistry and to some of the psychological approaches. And, of course, we had time, we'd also be discussing geriatrics, because a great deal has been done to focus discoveries upon making old age happier for people. But I think the thing you've emphasized more than anything else is that this field of scientific discoveries and its usefulness to man is just expanding like a fan opening up. Greater good for everybody concerned.
Depends on the application that we make of it. If we're wise enough to apply them in the potentialities they suggest, why, the future opens out wonderfully.
May we be that wise. Thank you, Mr. Cooley.
You've been listening to You and the World, Columbia's regular series of informal conversations on topics of current interest. This week, our subject is 1950s top scientific developments. And joining Dwight Cook today was Mr. Donald G. Cooley, widely known science writer and editor. Be with us again tomorrow, when Mr. Cook's guest will be Dr. Jasper H. Kane, a member of the team that discovered terramycin. Every Monday night, CBS brings you some of the finest programs on its schedule. Hollywood Star Playhouse, Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, the Lux Radio Theater, My Friend Irma, and The Bob Hawke Show. All are yours on most of these same CBS stations. This is CBS, where you hear Lux Radio Theater every Monday, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
You and the World with Dwight Cook. One of the most promising scientific developments of the past year was the discovery of a new antibiotic, another of the so-called wonder drugs. This one is terramycin, and today Mr. Cook has as his guest a member of the original team that discovered it. He is Mr. Jasper H. Kane, head of a biochemical research at Charles Pfizer and Company, Incorporated. Now, here's Dwight Cook.
Well, Mr. Kane, I don't know how many of our listeners already know about terramycin. Maybe I better spell it just for those who don't know of it. T-E-R-R-A-M-Y-C-I-N. But from what I've read, most of us are going to know something about it in pretty serious situations because, as my guest yesterday, Don Cooley, said, terramycin makes dying more difficult. Think that's a fair description of some of its possibilities for us?
Yes, I think that's a very clear and concise description of its possibilities.
Well, thanks to Mr. Cooley. Now, you can open this out and tell me why and wherefore it is a wonder drug. What's it do?
Well, terramycin does a great many things for human beings which none of the other antibiotics, and I'm especially referring to the well-known penicillin, can do. Penicillin, which is the most widely known, cures a great many infections. On the other hand, terramycin cures most of those infections as well as a great many more.
Well, start with me while I'm real young, Mr. Kane. When I'm a child, why is terramycin much better than anything you've had up to now?
Well, when you're a child, you're susceptible to such infections as whooping cough, certain forms of infant diarrhea, possibly some of the virus pneumonias, which often hit small children. All infections in which penicillin and some of the other known antibiotics are relatively ineffective.
So here in a whole field of child diseases, we've got a new weapon which really works on these.
Yes, we have.
And then if that child grows up in a sad period of the world like this and becomes a man fighting in Korea, terramycin is not such a bad thing to have around.
Well, I'm glad you referred to fighting in Korea because we believe that terramycin can be used very effectively in the treatment of most battlefield wounds. For example, it can be dusted on open wounds. It can be swallowed by a disabled soldier, a sailor. It's readily used. It's in a form that you don't have to inject, for example.
You have a very scientific approach towards this, Mr. Kane, because I've been told by other people that terramycin either cures or very favorably affects some 13 of the 18 major diseases, for instance, faced by GIs in Korea. That's quite a record.
Well, it's quite a record. It involves about 70% of them, but I suspect that that is a fairly accurate estimate.
Well, say it with a little more pleasure. You sound almost sad about it.
I think that's one difficulty with being in a scientific team. You tend to be very conservative and factual, Mr. Cook.
And also, I suppose you're regretting the other five that it doesn't hit, feeling there's an unfinished bit of business we ought to be in the middle of.
Well, you take one of the commonest forms of infection on the battlefield, gangrene in one form or other. Gangrene is usually caused by a species of bacteria known as the Clostridia. And terramycin has proven to be remarkably effective.
The most effective of any.
Well, certainly one of the most effective.
All right, I'll take that as a scientific being careful here. Well, then going on in this sad world around us, from what I've read, if and when we get more concerned with atom bombs, terramycin may not be wholly useless. Is that a scientific approach to it?
No, I think it would prove to be reasonably useful. Now, that statement is based entirely upon work done with animals who have been purposely given the so-called radiation sickness. It has shown a remarkable ability to protect them from the secondary infections and other results following upon overexposure to radiation. Incidentally, that's a condition that might occur were any of our largest cities to be successfully atom-bombed.
Fortunately, you've had no chance to test this out on a clinical scale with human beings.
Fortunately, we have not, and I hope we never do.
Well, now, there are three, however, very sensational areas. These children's diseases, which have been pretty stubborn at some of the earlier ways of trying to attack them. All the battle wounds and the atomic bomb. What else?
Well, it's very effective in treating urinary tract infections. In fact, its use in that field is spreading very rapidly from week to week. Both before and after operations on the urinary tract. Terramycin is being very successfully used to clear up primary infections, to prevent secondary infections.
And the social diseases?
Social diseases are responding very favorably to terramycin.
Quite a drug.
Ordinary syphilis, yaws in the southern hemisphere, and so forth.
Well, now, a minute ago, you alluded casually in passing to something which made me raise my ears a little bit. In the child diseases, you said virus pneumonia. You mean that this is a drug that really makes the virus lie down and say, Uncle?
Well, yes, Mr. Cook. In effect, that's just what it does in most cases. Unlike penicillin, which is relatively ineffective in virus pneumonias, terramycin, properly used, really takes over.
Well, really be more sensational about that. That's quite a discovery, because the whole field of diseases we haven't been able to reach lie in these viruses, and here is something that really works at them.
Well, talking about the use of terramycin in virus infections, I might mention that it's also been proven to be very effective in the treatment of infections caused by some of the larger viruses, the so-called rickettsiae, scrub typhus, typhus fever.
Rocky Mountain fever?
Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We can go beyond that into another branch of microorganisms known as the amoeba. Amoebic dysentery is one of the commonest infections caused by these organisms. And terramycin, in very recent tests by some of the foremost doctors in tropical medicine in this country and abroad, has been proven to be very effective in the treatment of such infections.
There is a very optimistic list of diseases and troubles which this peculiar thing known as terramycin works in. When did you start? When did you have the first terramycin? Do you start with having it?
Well, no. We really begin quite a ways before that. I'm sorry that we couldn't start with having it, but we had to start out searching for a new culture which would produce this new antibiotic.
Well, now, like the other antibiotics, terramycin is a mold. A spore, is it?
Well, it is produced by a mold. It's produced by a mold which the scientists call Streptomyces rhimosis. And this mold was discovered after a long and at times rather painful search from the viewpoint of one of the searchers for this rare species.
Well, now, how did you search for it? Where does one start looking for this unpronounceable scientific thing?
Well, one really starts looking in the old Mother Earth. It might have come, although it didn't, from the earth in your backyard or mine. In an actual historical story there, we enlisted the help of a great many of our friends, our representatives abroad, consular agents, travelers, explorers going into lightly traveled new regions of the world. We had samples of earth sent in from, to be a little poetic but truthful, from the banks of the Ganges, along the shores of the Amazon, over in Europe, around the Swiss Alps. However, I don't believe we received very much from behind the Iron Curtain as yet.
Well, don't divert me with that here, Mr. Kate. Suppose I wanted to try to help you find some more wonder drugs. I can't just take a teaspoon and go wandering for a teaspoonful of earth anywhere, can I? How do I know where to look?
Well, no one knows just where to look for the proper earth. In the course of our searching over, working over thousands and hundreds of thousands of samples of earth from different parts of the world, we have not only found terramycin, but we have rediscovered many times most of the already known antibiotics.
Like penicillin.
Such as penicillin, streptomycin, and so forth.
Well, when you get these samples of earth, assuming that people pick them up at random in odd places, how do you know which ones are going to have the antibiotics? Are they a different color, or do they don't stand up and say, look at me?
No, Mr. Cook, while they differ a great deal in color and physical appearance, such evident differences are no guide whatsoever as to whether they will contain an antibiotic-producing culture.
In other words, dirt is just plain dirt when it comes into your laboratory.
That's exactly what it is. But after a mycologist, now a bacteriologist, take a sample of this earth.
What's a sample, incidentally?
Oh, it might be a teaspoonful, small sample, and place it out on proper culture media, which permits the growth of these hundreds of mold and bacterial colonies. They're then able to isolate these different strains and test them for their antibiotic production.
Well, then, assuming they kill some of the things you want to kill, what do you do next?
Well, the next thing is to find out whether they're harmless enough to be used in human therapy, to be used on human beings.
You mean they could kill all the flu germs in me, but I wouldn't be there to know about it afterwards.
Exactly. For example, I remember one of our antibiotics, which we isolated in the early stages of our search. We called it number 11, and it really had a wonderful spectrum of activity. It seemed to be able to wipe out almost every disease bacteria which we tested it against. But man, when we put it into those poor little white mice, they just turned on their backs, stuck their toes up in the air, curled up their tails, and died. So we buried number 11 along with a lot of those mice shortly afterwards.
That gives me perhaps the first pessimistic association with number 11 I've ever had, Mr. Kane.
Well, number 11 does have a different significance in different situations.
Well, now, what has impressed me so much about terramycin, outside of all these wonderful things it does, is a time sequence in it. Because in reading about it and studying about it before you arrived, you people first found terramycin when, specifically?
Well, we found terramycin about a year or so ago.
Say July or August 1949?
Well, somewhere in that time, I would say.
Well, now in 1928...
Well, 1928 was the year that penicillin was discovered. But do you know that it wasn't until 1941... that penicillin was actually available in such form as rendering it available for injection into human beings?
Yes, and I remember the first time the man who got the injection, it stopped the blood poisoning, but there wasn't enough of it, and he died afterwards.
That was the sad ending.
That was a long stretch. That's what I was getting at. 1928 to the first availability in 1941. Here you discover this for the first time in the middle of 1949, and today I can buy it anywhere in the United States, can I?
Indeed you can, on prescription.
Well, again, sound more pleased, Mr. Kane. Sound more pleased with the fact I can. That's a tremendous accomplishment.
I think it's a tremendous accomplishment, too, frankly. In the space of a little more than a year, to develop such a worldwide clinical program with the cooperation of some of the most distinguished members of the medical profession throughout the world, to carry that forward to such a conclusion that we could afford, with the approval of our government, to place this on sale and offer it throughout the world. In doing that, all of us have done a great deal.
If I was an admiral, I'd like to send up a couple of flags at this point saying, well done.
Well, now, we're not stopping there, you know, Mr. Cook. We feel that this future horizon, so to speak, for new antibiotics is not even in sight. Until you see the horizon, you can hardly say that you can see your finish.
Well, you mean I can look forward to taking one pill once a week, sooner or later in here, and bang, go all the virus, all the bacteria?
I'm not sure about the one pill, but if you took enough of them, you'd probably clean up most of the bacteria and many of the larger viruses.
So you don't think the terramycin is anything like the last chapter, one of the final chapters?
No, I don't, frankly. Talking with the medical profession, it's evident that there's a great demand for better agents for the treatment of tuberculosis, effective drugs for use in the treatment of fungus infections, possibilities also in some of the neoplastic conditions.
Well, we will hope for the best there, Mr. Kane, and commend you and your fellow workers all over the country in finding it as soon as possible for us. Incidentally, of course, we haven't touched on an entirely different side of this story of antibiotics, and that's their effect on growth. And since that's one of the great discoveries of the year, we'll be talking about that this Thursday. But meantime, Mr. Kane, it's been a pleasure having you with me, and very thrilling to hear how this new wonder drug works and how it was discovered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook.
You've been listening to You and the World, Columbia's regular series of informal conversations on topics of current interest. This week, our subject is some of the top scientific developments of the past year. Joining Dwight Cook today was Mr. Jasper H. Kane, head of the biochemical research at Charles Pfizer and Company, Incorporated. Be with us again tomorrow when Mr. Cook's guest will be Dr. Irving S. Wright, president of the New York Heart Association. 1950 saw the second greatest incidence of infantile paralysis in the history of the U.S. It's estimated there were over 30,000 cases. But there's something each and every one of us can do to help cut that down. Give as much and as generously as you can to the March of Dimes. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.